Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. On June 26th, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Biden administration in Murphy v. Missouri. In its 6-3 ruling, the court reversed a decision by the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit that found that the administration had violated the plaintiff's First Amendment rights, finding instead that the plaintiffs did not have standing to bring the case, which centered around whether the Biden administration violated the First Amendment in its efforts to limit the spread of COVID-19 misinformation. In July 2021, after U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy called COVID-19 misinformation a threat to public health, President Biden told reporters that, quote, "the only pandemic we have is among the unvaccinated," unquote. He blamed Facebook for circulating and promoting COVID-19 vaccine hesitancy, saying publicly, "they're killing people." Behind the scenes, Biden's team and other federal agencies, like the Centers for Disease Control, were directly communicating with platform executives about content that they perceived as harmful. In May 2022, the states of Missouri and Louisiana filed a lawsuit alleging this open line of communication was overt government strong-arming, or jawboning, that gave rise to, quote, "open and explicit censorship programs," unquote. It further claimed the Biden administration colluded with social media companies to suppress speech under the guise of halting dis and misinformation. A district court ruled in favor of the states, issuing a preliminary injunction on the merits that the plaintiffs are likely to, quote, "succeed in, quote, establishing that the government has used its power to silence the opposition," unquote. The Fifth Circuit largely upheld the injunction and the central premise that the Biden administration's actions had violated free speech rights under the First Amendment. But the majority opinion in the Supreme Court offered a rebuke to the Fifth Circuit, which relied on a menagerie of materials in its decision, none of which supported the key claims made by the plaintiffs. Dean Jackson, a reporting fellow at Tech Policy Press, looked deeply at the evidentiary record and has been covering Murphy v. Missouri for us during the course of his fellowship. In this episode, Dean considers the outcome in the Supreme Court with three experts. Over to Dean.
I'm Dean Jackson, reporting fellow with Tech Policy Press. Today we're talking about the Supreme Court's ruling in Murphy v. Missouri. In a 6-3 decision, justices wrote that the plaintiffs, without any concrete link between their injuries and the defendant's conduct, ask us to conduct a review of the years-long communications between dozens of federal officials across different agencies with different social media platforms about different topics. This court's standing doctrine prevents us from exercising such general legal oversight of the other branches of government. We therefore reverse the judgment of the Fifth Circuit and remand the case for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. To help us sort through the importance of this ruling for free expression, tech policy, and American democracy, we have three guests today, and I'll allow them to introduce themselves.
Hi, my name is Olga Belgolova, and I am a professor at Johns Hopkins University. I am leading a program there called the Emerging Technologies Initiative, focused on different types of emerging technologies, and I used to lead the policy work on countering influence operations at Meta.
Hi, I'm Maisie Teitler. I'm a legal fellow at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, and in that role, I do a lot of work on litigation and public education on First Amendment and tech issues. I was also part of the team that authored the Knight Institute's amicus brief in the Murthy case.
Hi, Nina Jankowicz. I'm the co-founder and CEO of the American Sunlight Project, which is an advocacy group focused on disinformation and increasing the cost of lies that undermine democracy. I have been a researcher of disinformation, particularly of the foreign variety, for the better part of the last decade. And fun fact, I was actually an initial defendant in Murphy v. Missouri when it was filed.
Maisie, my first question is for you. So the Knight Institute, where you work, advocated for the court to clarify the legal questions around this sort of relationship between governments and speech and intermediaries, which is often referred to by the shorthand of jawboning. Your institute advocated to adapt the standards set in a previous case, Bantam Books versus Sullivan. That case isn't actually referenced in the opinion, which surprised me because they did reference your work in the oral arguments. It is referenced, however, 6 times in Alito's dissent. And so I was wondering if first you could give our listeners a quick refresher on Bantam, because I think it's a really useful primer for this case. But also, what do you make of the citations and lack thereof in those opinions?
So the substantive question in Bantam is really similar to the substantive question in Murthy, which is the question of at what point government efforts to pressure what we call speech intermediaries, which are entities that are involved in the publication or distribution of other people's speech, at what point those efforts to pressure entities to take down or promote speech violates the First Amendment. So until this year, Bantam Books was the most recent Supreme Court decision on that question. It was from 1963, which is a very long time ago. And in that case, the plaintiffs, who were publishers, challenged the actions of a Rhode Island State Commission that was created to protect minors from obscene or offensive materials. And that commission would send notices out to book distributors, so the people who take the books from the publishers and help get the books placed into bookstores or libraries. And those notices threatened prosecution unless the distributors would pull specific books or magazines from circulation. And the commission would then follow up on its requests, send police officers to booksellers to see if they were complying with what it directed them to do. And unsurprisingly, most distributors would refuse to fill new orders for materials that the commission deemed unfit and would send field workers to remove unsold books from retailers' shelves. So the Supreme Court back in 1963 held that those actions were together a scheme of informal censorship that violated the First Amendment that was designed at intimidating book distributors and retailers with criminal prosecution and resulted in the suppression of this protected speech that the publishers were putting out. One thing that's very important about that case is that the court concluded that even though the commission was only using informal sanctions to try to achieve its goals, the way it was trying to use those informal sanctions were coercive and ultimately succeeded in suppressing the speech. And the court tried to draw this line and acknowledge that not all communications with intermediaries about speech necessarily violate the First Amendment. And it explicitly preserved a role for government in kind of consulting and aiding intermediaries to comply with the law, and also reserved this right to make purely advisory and non-coercive communications. So a number of courts in the years in between 1963 and now had interpreted that to mean that there's this line that matters between government persuasion, which is allowed, and coercion, which isn't allowed. But obviously the factual context around Bantam is really different than the factual context around Murthy. So my colleagues and I here at the Knight Institute really hoped that the court would address some of the substantive questions that were raised by the plaintiffs. And ultimately, I think the reason the majority's opinion doesn't cite Bantam is because it was at this early stage. It was about standing. And standing is this legal doctrine that is basically used to determine who is the right person to bring a case, when you can and can't sue. And the plaintiffs had sought a preliminary injunction, which is an early order to ask a court to tell a defendant to stop doing some allegedly harmful behavior. The injunction at the Supreme Court was struck down because the court thought that the plaintiffs didn't meet the standing requirements to receive the injunction in the first place. So it's no longer in effect. Which means the case now goes all the way back to the district court for additional proceedings. And the plaintiffs have said they want to get more discovery to get more evidence to prove their claims. But ultimately, to your main question about why Bantam didn't come up, because the court didn't answer the substantive questions, it didn't expressly state that Bantam was the right framework for analyzing these specific claims. But we can maybe try to read the tea leaves a little bit and say standing is related to the merits. So you need to demonstrate when you want prospective standing that there's a likelihood you'll be injured in the future. And the court suggested at a few points in its opinion that coercion, which is the standard that's derived from Bantam, may be the right way to analyze these claims. And so one way to read this ruling is effectively that this generalized pressure campaign isn't enough to demonstrate the likelihood of future injury that might violate the First Amendment, and that you might need some more specific pressure. And the reason that the opinion comes up more in Alito's dissent is because he thought that at least one of the plaintiffs had standing. And so he went on to discuss the underlying questions and applied Bantam. And I guess I'd be remiss to mention that the court did reaffirm and apply Bantam in the other Jawbunning case before it this term, NRA v. Vullo. And we can maybe guess that the court would be likely to apply that test in a case similar to Murthy, but it's not 100% clear because it didn't reach the substantive questions in this case how it would apply in the social media context. Long answer.
No, that's great. It might be worth very briefly just describing what the conduct at question in Vullo too, because it is, I think, so much more explicit and overt than what the factual record in Murthy shows. I also have some questions about general legal tea reading for you later, but if you want to say a word about Vullo, I think it would be interesting.
Sure. So NRA v. Velo was a case that was brought by the National Rifle Association related to various actions that Maria Velo, who used to be the superintendent of New York's Department of Financial Services, took. And the NRA alleged that Velo violated the First Amendment in her communications with these regulated financial parties that were offering certain NRA affiliate insurance programs. And some of those insurance products were unlawful under New York law. And the NRA was at an earlier stage, the motion to dismiss stage, and had alleged that Velo, in a series of letters and also some communications in backroom meetings, said that if the regulated entities stopped offering these products, it would no longer investigate and press charges on the idea that some of them were unlawful. And the NRA lost its argument below, but ultimately the Supreme Court on appeal said that was a kind of good enough, close enough pleading that the case should move beyond the initial motion to dismiss, and the plaintiff should be able to test whether they can get discovery and get more evidence and see whether the case should proceed.
Nina, I want to turn to you. Because your organization, you recently stood up a new organization called the American Sunlight Project, which has done some research on the actors who supported this case as it made its way all the way up and now it seems all the way back down the legal system. In the interest of transparency, I should disclose that I helped with some of that research. And although we've known each other a long time, long before you started American Sunlight, and you know, you're not currently paying me and didn't pay for access to this podcast.
Correct.
But I do wonder if you could tell us about the network of journalists, lawyers, billionaires, and politicians who essentially helped this case, built on the foundation of a conspiracy theory, make it all the way up to the justices.
Yeah. So without giving too much away of that report, which will be coming out, if all goes well, later this July, I think the important thing to note is that there are some, let's call them bloggers in this sphere, who have made some pretty wild allegations about the way content moderation practices at social media platforms are influenced by the federal government and by independent academic researchers. These bloggers, I feel like they're kind of a little like Voldemort. I don't want to say their names to give them extra amplification, but these folks have made these allegations in ways that have benefited them monetarily, because they're doing them on Substack. So every time they make a salacious allegation, it generates more income for them, more subscribers. They raise just enough questions to bring up a potential congressional investigation. And we haven't yet mentioned Jim Jordan in this podcast, so I feel like now is as good a time as ever. So Congressman Jim Jordan, as I'm sure many listeners and readers of the Tech Policy Press podcast and Tech Policy Press writ large know that Congressman Jordan has been, since he gained chairmanship of the House Judiciary Committee, issuing subpoenas and requests for documents, transcribed interviews and depositions, not only among the disinformation research community, but among many federal officials as well. When he issues those requests for documents, somehow those documents then end up in the hands of folks like Stephen Miller at America First Legal, who has been one of the big backers behind suits like this. And I think that's a really important point too. We're talking about SCOTUS today. We're talking about this, you know, important decision, but this is one in several cases that have been really targeted at not only, again, disinformation researchers, but individual parts of the federal government in order to hamstring them ahead of the 2024 election from responding to all of the disinformation that we're seeing. That is the broad kind of information laundering cycle that we have seen and that we map out in this report. And then the other thing that we lay out, in addition to laying out what's at stake financially for the bloggers who are making these claims, we look at the funding going into entities like America First Legal, which is supported by some of the largest conservative donors in the political ecosystem. We're talking tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars over years. Certainly year over year, we're looking in the high tens of millions of dollars. And so this isn't just thinking about somebody's speech who's been harmed, right? This is a very deliberate and concerted effort from the conservative ecosystem in order to pressure independent researchers, tech platforms, and the government again ahead of the 2024 election. And without saying that they're winning, I mean, I think there are so many people who are standing up to this very bravely, and we're trying to help them as much as we can. And certainly, I mentioned before, I was one of the initial defendants in what was then Missouri v. Biden, which again belies how ridiculously politicized the case was, and we can explain some of that later. But it is definitely a huge amount of pressure on the research community, and it is extremely well-funded and coordinated pressure. And I just want people to recognize that this isn't just something that's organically coming up through the legal system. It is, by every definition of the word, lawfare.
That's a great note to end that answer on, because I was going to follow up and ask, and maybe you can say a little bit more about what else could be done to draw those lines, right? To, not to sound too conspiratorial, but to connect the piece of string to all of the parts of the bulletin board, right? I don't think that the general public sees all of the pieces in the same way you do. I don't know that, even though all these pieces have been covered in the press, I don't know if the whole picture has been covered in the press the same way.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we decided to do this piece of research as kind of our first big report. It is a difficult story to tell, because you end up looking like the meme from the guy from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, right? Like, it actually does look like that when you map out all the connections. But when one individual had his home raided by the IRS, he immediately went to Jim Jordan for help, right? Shows a pretty close relationship. And again, it's not every American citizen's job to look at how document requests from Congress are then being shuttled into political apparatuses in order to launch cases like this, but it is indeed what's happening. And it was happening in slow motion for a really long time. But now we have out in front of us this causal chain of evidence that has led, of course, to not only pressure and harassment and threats against these researchers, but we know, of course, that some of these institutions have now decided to pack it in. Stanford Internet Observatory, very famously and much talked about over the last couple of weeks, has moved what remained of its work to other parts of it and let go to the preeminent researchers who were leading that institution. That's a clear effect. And I think clearly Jim Jordan and those around him were celebrating that. Can you imagine celebrating the closure of a research institution in the United States of America? I don't know. That sounds pretty McCarthyist to me. And as somebody who's been on the receiving end of a lot of this stuff and who had the pleasure of sitting across from Jim Jordan and his staff for 5 hours, right? I can tell you that the questions that they're asking and the motivation behind what they're doing is not anything to do with free speech. It's about scoring political points. So I think, yeah, the press does need to do a better job. I'm hoping we can give them some of the pieces of that puzzle. But for most Americans, I think we need to distill this story into something that is bite-sized and easy to understand. And that's why I always go back to this framework of this is a 21st century McCarthy Inquisition against people who have an intention to tell the truth. And that's not something that's American. That's not something that no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, anybody should be standing up for, this harassment of independent researchers who are just trying to do good work.
I think it'd be worth pointing out to any listeners that the transcript from that 5-hour conversation you had with Jim Jordan and his staff is publicly available. You can go read it. And I think it's noteworthy for the sort of lack of explosive material there, right? It's interesting, but I don't really recall seeing any real bombshells, but it's not the only transcript available.
They've released 3 now. And one of the things that we're trying to do with American Sunlight is continue to pressure the Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government to release all of the transcripts with researchers, because they have the authority to withhold them. And this has all been conducted, of course, using taxpayer funding. And they are making wild allegations, continuing to make wild allegations to this day, that they have evidence that coercion or jawboning was happening, when in fact, I know from other folks that we've interviewed as well, none of us said that anything like that was happening, and we were under oath, right? I think it's notable that we all had to fight for those transcripts to get released. In Kate Starbird and Alex Stamos's case, those seem to have been released as retaliation for them having spoken to 60 Minutes when 60 Minutes did a piece on Jim Jordan and attacks on researchers. And in my case, it was only because I made things really difficult for them and they wanted me to go away. But yeah, there's no explicit material in there because the reality of what we were doing in my former position in the U.S. government and the researchers who were also interviewed whose transcripts have been released, the reality is very boring and anodyne. We were trying to improve the health of the American information ecosystem. And I guess for some people that is something that is explosive, but we are just people and we got caught on the wrong end of a political fight.
Speaking of the health of the information ecosystem, I want to turn to Olga. Olga, you previously led Meta's policy team that worked to counter influence operations. Meta and other social media platforms mostly stayed silent about this case. NetChoice, the industry lobbying group that they're members of, filed an amicus brief, but it filed in support of neither side. And I just wondered if, as a former threat investigator, you could help us understand the implications of the ruling for 2024 and subsequent elections, especially from the perspective of people working in trust and safety policy now. How important are the kind of communications between government and platforms that were restricted by the preliminary injunction issued earlier in the case? How did those communications affect your work?
Yeah, so I would say in my experience, those communications were extremely important. In fact, the timely communications have been actually pretty crucial for elections integrity work in the past. And I can give you some very specific examples of that, one from 2018 and one from 2020, but there are many others and not just from the United States of America. So in 2018, the Russian Internet Research Agency, which I led the investigation on back in 2017 through 2019 at Meta, they were attempting to run what we would call a perception hacking operation. They created a website purporting to have interfered significantly in the midterm election in 2018 and even had a fake whistleblower put out a YouTube video pretending to have quit the troll farm and saying that this is all the stuff that we did. Now, most people in the United States, or even maybe most of you on this call, probably never saw that video. And the reason for that is timely intelligence sharing. Both that video and the fake accounts pretending to be Americans on both sides of the aisle were removed, and the Russian effort in 2018 was less punchy because what they were trying to do was to make it seem like they had done this massive interference effort. And even on their website, in all caps, they had written, "We have interfered. Your intelligence agencies and companies are powerless against us, and we've done all this terrible stuff." But the reason it didn't really work so well is because both the companies and the US government were able to put out intelligence to the U.S. population at the time that said, "Hey, we found this, we took this down. It wasn't actually up for very long, and it wasn't really effective." And so it took the entire punch out of the whole operation, and that coordination was extremely important. Another example from 2020, and a different threat actor. So with Iran, timely communications were really important when the Iranians were impersonating the Proud Boys, emailing voters to intimidate them. Those timely communications meant that the Iranian video purporting to hack voting systems never actually made it very far. And that was during the Trump administration, where Trump administration intelligence officials went to the podium in front of the public and said, "We were able to take down this Iranian operation and protect voters from getting intimidated by these fake Proud Boys and by this purported hack of voting systems." And so those are two very different examples, but examples that show that this is important to all American voters. Doesn't really matter which side of the aisle they're on, but this is protecting them. These conversations matter. Now, to be clear, the initial court ruling included carve-outs that authorized the executive branch communication with social media platforms on issues related to national security threats and election interference. But from my experience, again, I quit Meta about a year ago and have been working as a professor since then and even before that. But what I know is that I've talked to a lot of government officials I've stayed in touch with, friends of mine, and they found it very difficult to continue engagement with the intelligence teams at these companies. And it cooled those conversations because people didn't really know how to act appropriately and and they were waiting for decisions to be made that they knew how to engage. And that meant that a lot of these conversations were just simply not happening. And most of my engagements in my work, both as an intelligence analyst working at Meta, leading the Russia investigation, and then as a policy lead working on countering influence operations, most of those engagements were similar to intelligence sharing between one intelligence agency and another. Anyone that's a student of intelligence knows that intelligence agencies are not designed to be prescriptive in their analysis. And so when that sharing was happening, it was, here's some information that you might want to see. And that happened in both directions. And then do with it what you will, right? And then policymakers make decisions with that intelligence that they've gleaned. And even I spent time both in the intelligence team and on the policy teams. And the way it works is that threat intelligence teams investigate, they find cases, and through a rigorous review process that we designed, policy experts are making determinations about whether and which policy violations took place, and then what actions to take that are appropriate based solely on the evidence. And that's really important. At no point in time during my experience working with the US government did I feel pressured to make any kind of policy decisions to remove anything. We can have a separate conversation about some of the other governments around the world, including liberal democracies that have done that. And that's important to have those conversations. And that's why I think this case, for all of the harm that it's caused to researchers that have just been outlined, I think the conversation that we need to have needs to be had, right? We need to have a conversation about balancing freedom of expression with these policy decisions. We need to think about how we protect users without limiting speech. But we need to have those conversations rooted in fact, which is precisely what the justices said, that this wasn't factual or based on conjecture and conspiracy. Thankfully, the judges came to that conclusion as well. But that's the conversation we need to be having. We need to be rooting it in fact.
Can I jump in there, actually? I just think there's one thing that I want to tease out from what Olga just said, and I agree wholeheartedly with all of it. It's that also on the civil servant side of things, the people who are handling communications with platforms, these are typically, again, they're civil servants, career civil servants who have been doing their jobs for a long time, typically speaking. They are not political appointees. They are people who have families to feed. They are people who need benefits. And when you get an injunction like the one that came down last July 4th in 2023 saying, okay, you're not to talk to any of these institutions or platforms with these very specific carve-outs, first of all, it's going to be really difficult as a working level person to navigate that stuff. As Olga said, they were looking for that guidance from above, which I think maybe came down in some cases in different agencies and probably in others, they were just like, oh, we're going to stay away from this. But also, if you're going to find something and you see what's happened to people like me and other federal officials or former federal officials who have been caught in the midst of all of this, you're going to think twice before you raise the alarm bell, even about something as serious as foreign interference in elections or disinformation relating to national security. If it might mean that your family gets doxxed and there are threats coming your way, because this has happened multiple times against many folks in the administration now, I just think you can't discount that chilling effect. And so I was really glad to see this case thrown out on the basis that, you know, it didn't have the evidence needed to push it forward. And I wholeheartedly agree, as I said with Olga, that we do need to have that conversation. And I think we'll be getting that to that, Dean, if I remember correctly, as we shift to the second part of the conversation.
Yeah, I do want to get into that because I think all of us have, in one form or another, said that more transparency, more structure around these communications and in the social media environment more generally would be a positive thing. It's unfortunate that this is the venue we have in which to have that debate. And hopefully we can talk about what a more productive conversation might look like in 2025. But first, for the group, I want to just throw this out there for anyone who cares to answer. I want to talk about the future of First Amendment law, social media policy, election integrity efforts, and the way this case has influenced them, even though it's now, a lot of the air has now been let out of it. This case and the events associated with it have already done a lot of damage to the field of disinformation research. Reference the Stanford Internet Observatory and its downsizing, I think we can call it, as a result of the legal costs that Stanford has had to incur. How do we begin to repair that damage? And what trends worry you for the future? Because I don't think this is going to settle the debate forever. And so how should we prepare for what might be next?
I know I might sound like a bit of a broken record here, and I'm just going to say this again, but rigor and fact-based analysis is the only path forward. We can't stoop to the level of individuals who put their case forward based on conjecture, and we can't do that as a research community either. Again, I know it's sort of annoying to say that, like, when they go low, we go high kind of thing, and we've heard that in so many different situations in the recent past. But unfortunately, in my time reading work on Russian influence operations as an investigator and intelligence analyst, I did see a lot of enthusiastic claims from researchers that were simply wrong and speculative, and from governments too. And that's not to say that they influenced the work, because the work was still done based on the evidence available, but we can do better than that. And I think you have to be untouchable, which is really hard to do. But as a policy leader at Meta, one of the things that I did was I worked with a team of investigators and I held them to a very high standard. Together with my colleagues, including people who worked in across legal teams, communications teams, policy teams, we created a really rigorous process to review every single case so that we had evidence to support the policy decisions on specifically, I'm talking about coordinated authentic behavior and any attribution claims that we made. Because I will say that over the years, especially when I was leading work on Russia, there were a lot of researchers that came forward and claimed that things were Russia when they were not. And we sometimes give Russia a lot more credit than they deserve. And we also have to make a very clear distinction. I know, again, I'm a broken record on this, and it's the thing that I've become famous for, but really bugs me when we say misinformation and disinformation in one sentence, because they're different things and they mean different things. And saying them together, blurring them together, putting a slash between them only serves to help people like the ones that put this case forward, because it makes it confusing, right? When people are engaging in speech versus a deliberate effort to deceive. We have to make a distinction with how we talk about these problems so that people understand that when we're dealing with people who are lying because they are misinformed, that there is a different set of policies that address those things. And when we're dealing with foreign interference threat actors, there is a completely different set of policies, right? People are not, the punitive actions are different because the person who is misinformed just does not know any better. And so how do we make policies that actually help those people do literacy programs and other things like that, that are not rooted in stifling their speech, but in understanding where they're coming from, and then making a very clear distinction between how we deal with Russian interference, Iranian interference, Chinese interference, and all kinds of other threat actors. Because the problem is the lines in this whole field are very blurry, and we have to, as researchers, unblur them as much as possible. Because over the years, when we were looking for foreign interference cases, our investigative team found a lot of domestic cases around the world where governments were trying to influence their domestic populations and were creating fake accounts to do that. And a lot of times, importantly, very importantly, the actual cases that are the most famous cases in this whole field do not involve false information. They involve fake accounts, people pretending to be someone that they're not. But most of what they're doing is just further dividing and polarizing people based on existing societal fissures and not actually having to make up any false facts. Based on the research that I've done, false information is not actually, if we just focused on that and just addressing that, then we would be missing a whole part of what influence operations have been for the last 7 years, if not for the last 30 years since the Cold War.
I think we could have a separate hour-long conversation about how important that is and how much the assumption that everything involved in influence operations is false has shaped the response, probably to the detriment of the field. But I wanted to give Mina and Maisie a chance to weigh in also. What is this set the stage for? What are you looking out for now?
Well, one of the things that we're trying to do with American Sunlight is when we do a report, we're doing everything as to the extent possible in open source and accessible ways so that people can recreate the work that we've done. And I think that's really important, not that most readers will go to that, but that level. But this way, if there is criticism, we can say, this is what's out there in the public domain. We're not slicing and dicing things that we've been given from certain tech billionaires who have given us access to to internal communications, cough, Twitter files, cough, but making sure that people can recreate this as they see fit. We're not using things that aren't accessible to everybody else. And I think that's really important. But we are also trying to make sure that we're telling a good story. And I think one of the issues that we've had in the academic research community is balancing, as Olga has just said, the facts with the desire to tell a good story. And some people went too far in the kind of salacious, crazy way and left nuance on the table. We don't want to do that. But we also need to find a way to cut through the BS that the other side is selling. And so I think for us, a strategic communications effort is really important. And that word used to get thrown around all the time, especially in Central and Eastern Europe and in Ukraine, where I worked for a couple of years a while ago, back in 2016, 2017. Strategic communications were seen as like the antidote to disinformation. I don't think that's true. I think good storytelling can go a long way. But we need to think more like communicators, is what I'm saying. Often in the academic and research communities, we hope that we put the stuff out there and the journalists on the other side will take it and run with it and get it to the audiences that need to see it. But I think what we've learned is that as these attacks have surfaced and we've, in some cases, made the deliberate choice and in some cases been forced into letting other people do the storytelling for us, the narrative has gotten warped. And so I would say to everybody listening to this who may be affected by this sort of thing, first of all, you don't need to engage in that sort of strategic silence necessarily. You don't need to be erring toward the most dry academic prose possible. Think about how you would describe something if you were trying to tell an aunt, an uncle, your parents about what you do in layman's terms. That's the story that we really need to tell, and tell it in human terms. That's something that's really been key to my efforts over the past 2 years since I resigned from government and fell victim to some bad communications myself. I think we can't discount how important they are as we go forward, because the other side is telling a really good story right now. And that's part of the reason this case made it as far as it did.
It's a story made for TV, right? It's the foundation of Murphy v. Missouri is a storytelling effort. Of course, it's dramatic and eye-catching. And on the other side of it are institutions that are set up very much to do their work in the background in a technocratic way. And really, if you're doing it not in a way that is designed to create sensationalism or to attract attention. And we have to learn, I think, you're right, to respond to the sort of reality television show that the people who you've talked about being behind this case are putting on with something that is both truth-based and compelling. Which is a hard tightrope to walk, but it has to be in the mind of everybody who's responding to these things. Maisie, do you have any thoughts on, especially since you bring such a valuable and different perspective to the conversation, on kind of what's next for free speech litigation?
Yeah, I have a few different thoughts. And I guess maybe I'll start with a little bit of optimism that I feel coming out of this decision. So the first is that even though this case, as we all know, was mostly about government communicating directly with the platforms, it did, because the pleadings were very muddled and the record was very lengthy, 20,000 pages, it sometimes implicated private actors like the Stanford Internet Observatory, like the Election Integrity Project. And something that I want to highlight and that I really hope the lower courts are super attentive to is that in the opinion, Justice Barrett's opinion notes that for one of the plaintiffs, his content was flagged by the Election Integrity Project rather than a public entity. And the court used that fact to support, as to his standing argument, the conclusion that his injuries just weren't closely connected enough to government action to support a legal First Amendment job hunting claim. I think that's a really heartening fact that the court intentionally highlighted to hopefully preserve a little more breathing room for independent researchers. And I think it's easy to see in that a repudiation of these sort of attempts to muddy all these facts together and implicate private researchers, implicate the government, and make it a bigger and more complicated conspiratorial type of case than there may actually be any grounds to support. So I'm really, really heartened by that. And the fact that the court's ruling generally in the standing context repudiates this narrative that there was a vast government conspiracy to coerce platforms into censoring speech, even though we can be frustrated that it didn't reach the merits of the case. Kicking the case out on standing is a rejection of that attempt to muddle things together and implicate independent researchers. And I think it's very good that we aren't living in a world where many more independent non-government affiliated researchers' work is even more threatened by a decision that lumps them in as government actors just by virtue of communicating with the platforms. I guess I also want to take seriously the idea that although this isn't the world we're maybe living in right now, when there are concrete instances of government pressure that's intended to suppress content, that is concerning. And so if you saw government investigations in the future, one implication of this decision is that those investigations would hopefully be focused on more concrete instances of censorship if they exist, rather than, as we've seen so far, propping up these broad allegations of government coercion in a way that can then be weaponized against researchers. And so I think the silver lining of this case is that these efforts to paint really broad government campaigns to influence content moderation with a really broad brush and deliberately muddy the waters are less viable as a legal theory. And it seems less likely after today's ruling that communications that come out in the course of those types of investigations will actually lead to any liability for government actors. So hopefully that will incentivize people who want the government to be involved in communicating and providing an accurate source of information from trying to bring as much of this litigation. We'll only be able to see with time. And as has already been correctly highlighted, there are plenty of these jawboning cases moving in various different types of theories in the lower courts, and we'll have to see how the lower courts handle them for now. At the same time, it's extremely disappointing that going into an election cycle, we have so little guidance on the limits that the First Amendment places on government efforts to pressure, because we have this avalanche of hearings and litigation on this topic that's already done so much damage to the field of disinformation research. And while we, and this is to Olga's point earlier, while we lack any substantive guidance about what's impermissible and permissible, it's pretty possible that we'll see disinformation researchers and government entities and platforms refraining from communications that might be permissible under any substantive rule that the court would announce, and also would just be like desirable for all of us as people living in an information ecosystem that needs to function. Because all of those actors are concerned about the possibility of litigation and not only the consequences of litigation, but also the possibility of doxing, the possibility of real lived harms are all live and extremely concerning. And it's really disheartening to see a world in which attempts to address disinformation and misinformation are so harmful. And again, at the same time as, and Renee Diresta made this point really cogently in a guest essay for the New York Times last month, but all these efforts to undercut disinformation research are coming at a time when AI-generated audio and video and text is being used more frequently and more efficaciously to influence election outcomes, and trust in traditional media sources is really low. So I think, I don't know how you go about addressing all of those really real harms, but it is the one implication of this decision not being substantive is that we just don't have more clear guidance there, and that's really concerning. And then I think one last point is that it's maybe not a state of First Amendment point, but it is a state of the world problem, is that there are issues of concentration of private power over speech that the First Amendment isn't really well constructed to address because it's targeted at government action. So part of the reason why this story, I think to use a term that Dean said, is dramatic and eye-catching, is that there are a small number of platforms where most speech online happens for most people, and those platforms aren't really incentivized to protect their users, because speech is a little bit cheaper on a social media platform than it might be for a publisher, right? The publisher in Bantam Books is really hurt when the books can't be sold because it directly cuts into their profit margins. If in a world where there's a well-pleaded jawboning case and an individual piece of content gets taken down as a result of government pressure, it doesn't cut into the platform's bottom line very much if one or two pieces come down. But platforms acting as that choke point makes them really attractive targets for government censorship. I think this case was weak because of these attenuated connections between the government action and the plaintiff's content. But even in stronger cases, an outcome of this case would be that it's harder for plaintiffs to win. It's easier for the government to be vague, to censor by proxy, and make it hard for the plaintiffs to demonstrate that their speech was suppressed as a result of government coercion. And so I think for that point, transparency in these communications is really important. But the First Amendment just may not be well positioned to provide that transparency.
And I'll just really quickly add, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but I think we're talking about the United States here, but there are other countries where this kind of activity and countries that you may not expect, right? The automatic assumption is India and Singapore, and those are definitely places for people to look at and study how they are pressuring companies to do things. In fact, threatening the employees of companies with arrest and physical harm when they don't take some kind of actions. But there's also countries like Lithuania, where they basically have this pretty crazy anti-bot law that is going to fine companies and threaten them for not taking down things that the Lithuanian government deems to be bots, right? And that's a very loose interpretation. And so it's basically based on what one researcher in Lithuania tells the Lithuanian government is bots. And so that's a little bit scary, right? Like you think about some places where exactly what Maisie just described is happening, where, and the reason, obviously, it sounds like a talking point when the companies are asking for regulation, but I worked with a lot of lawyers, really well-meaning, smart lawyers who are cybersecurity, who experts in cybersecurity law, worked at the Justice Department. And the reason the companies are asking for regulation is because they want guardrails, just like the government does, to understand what can and cannot be done, because otherwise they're having to make these decisions all over the world on their own and subject to lawsuits like this one.
We've touched on this point a few times now. And Nina, you wrote recently a piece for MSNBC explaining not just how this crusade against counter-disinformation efforts affected you personally, but you used the piece to say that legislators have really punted on kind of legitimate questions about social media oversight and transparency. You say that you hope in 2025 a new Congress might prioritize these issues. What specifically would you advise the next Congress to consider doing? And in the range of things they could do, which ones are most important?
Yeah. First of all, a girl can dream, right? I don't know if we're actually going to get a Congress that is willing to deal with these issues. It's been, I feel like Rose and Titanic. It's been, whatever, 92 years, and I still smell the fresh paint. I still feel the issues that we've had over the past 8 years that people have been begging for the members of Congress to solve, and they've done nothing about it. We haven't had a single piece of tech regulation passed that addresses any of the issues that the tech companies or citizens have been asking for. We can't even get regulations around non-consensual deepfake pornography passed. And it's not like that's been a new issue. People have been bringing it up for 8 years. So I'm frustrated with them. But back to your original question, I think the most important thing is some oversight and transparency legislation. And to bring up Stanford again, Nate Persley at Stanford had a really great proposal for a bill that he worked with some folks in Congress on, and I'm forgetting the exact name of the proposal now, but it looked to share data with research institutions and provided mechanisms for that to happen so that when we were having conversations about how social media content regulation or content moderation was happening, we were having it based on facts instead of based on these tiny snippets of hearsay from whistleblowers, from leaks, from FOIA requests, if things went to Congress and other branches of government, et cetera. And I think having that fulsome conversation is the place that we need to start when we're talking about any tech regulation in the future. Because as I said, right now we're operating almost entirely in the dark based on the little snippets of information that we have. So we need to start there with some transparency regulation. I know Tech Policy Press has done a lot of work on the DSA. We are in the midst of figuring out how their disclosures and data access provisions are going to be working in Europe. I'm not saying that model is going to be the one that the United States settles on, but something in that vein that allows anybody who has the correct credentials, which of course is the sticking point, right? Who do you give the access to and who do you not give it to? And to access that data and tell those stories to the public, I think is where we need to start. We could go on for hours talking about other stipulations for regulation, but that's where I see the most important first step. And then from there, the rest of the regulation can trickle down.
Yeah, I think the name of the draft bill that Nate personally submitted was the Platform Accountability and Transparency Act. Maisie, I wanted to ask you a couple of follow-up questions too. First off, we haven't really talked about the net choice rulings regarding the Florida and Texas laws. And those are, of course, a little different because they do deal with sort of state efforts to compel different types of speech from the platforms. But it does strike me that the people who have been advocating for those laws are now 0-3 on these cases. I wonder if that could be surprising to some observers since it is a tilted court, a 6-3 court with a conservative majority. So I wonder if you might want to talk about that. But I also wondered if it matters that the plaintiffs in this case represented users who felt their speech had been infringed upon rather than intermediaries who felt that they were pressured. And if a future case brought by a platform, let's just say X, if that might have attracted more sympathy from the justices. We're in the land of speculation here, but I am curious what you think, as you said earlier, the legal tea leaves might suggest.
Yeah, hopefully I can maybe answer those kind of two parts of your question together. So I think it does matter to some extent that the plaintiffs here were users and not the intermediaries themselves. So if a platform like X were to bring a suit like this, they'd probably be either asserting that their own editorial judgment is being harmed, posts they choose to keep up, the ones they choose to take down as being influenced by the government's action, or they'd somehow be trying to argue, I think, that their editorial judgment's being influenced in a way that harms the speech rights of their users. And there's obviously a little bit of conceptual overlap between that and the argument in NetChoice that the platforms are kind of editors under the First Amendment and so are entitled to editorial discretion. I'm not an expert on NetChoice, but I think one kind of good upshot of that case is that the court, you know, rejected the very broad arguments that were made by the states and the very broad arguments by the social media platforms. So it recognized that the platforms have editorial judgment that maybe matters under the First Amendment, but dismisses, and I think for good reasons, that all regulation in this sphere is categorically unconstitutional. And if we were to see a case similar to this one brought on behalf of the platforms, you might see a job hunting case or a job hunting S case that would be more likely to succeed because a platform is just better positioned to demonstrate the relationship between the request and its own policies. There's less of these attenuation issues that affected the plaintiff's standing in Murthy, and that might be a stronger case. At the same time, for the reasons I was saying earlier, platforms don't have amazing incentives to bring a lot of these cases as litigation. Like we flagged in our brief and like I mentioned before, platforms don't have the same stake in content as traditional publishers and so are less maybe worried about a single piece of content among the billions that might be on the site coming down. And concentration just makes it easier to exercise the type of pressure that the First Amendment might find concerning because there's just fewer pain points you have to push, for lack of a better term. Alito made a lot of this kind of related issue in his dissent that the platforms, although they're rich and powerful, can be vulnerable to government pressure, not only for the reasons I just said, but also because they are dependent on Section 230 immunity and vulnerable to antitrust litigation. And so I think it's hard to know for sure, and it's hard to know what kind of theory a platform might put forward. But I think coming out of this term, we know that the Supreme Court is willing to recognize at least some First Amendment editorial discretion rights in the platforms, and also that they want more clear evidence of a relationship between the challenged government action and the content and the plaintiff, and a platform may be much better to produce that than an individual user.
Olga, I want to give you the last question. A lot has changed in the social media trust and safety landscape since this case was first filed. There have been layoffs, new platforms like Threads have been released, Twitter transformed into X, generative AI captured a lot of lawmaker attention. Given those changes, does this case put the industry back into business as usual, or is that impossible now? And what would you advocate if changes do need to be made, given the changed environment, that the industry and government do to protect election integrity moving forward?
I think one thing that I often got asked over the last however many months because of this case, but because of the broad environment that you just described, is but whether things are worse now than they were in 2016. And my resounding answer to that has always been no, because there are still quite a few, like there's a whole research community around this problem set. There are still dozens, if not hundreds of people that do this work at different companies, perhaps not at X, but at many of the other companies. And I've had people come up to me and say, oh, it's too bad your team doesn't exist anymore at Meta. And I'm like, no, it's all still there. All the people that I worked with, all the intelligence analysts, all the policymakers, all of those people are still there and doing that work. And that's not just the case at Meta. And so I think it's important, again, I'm also thinking about the Russian perception of this problem set, which is trying to make people believe that there is no one watching the walls. But there are a lot of people doing this work, and we are better off, much better off than we were in 2016, and in fact, probably better off than we were in 2018. 2020, I would say that the main difference between now and 2020 is that cooling effect that we were talking about earlier. And that cooling effect, I think it's important to acknowledge that it doesn't just impact the government and its ability to talk to the companies, but it goes the other way around and the company's abilities to talk to government, but also the company's self-censorship. I was a journalist. I worked in Russia as a reporter years ago, and I was in a newsroom that was a really good Russian publication when my parents lived in the Soviet Union, and I saw them self-censoring themselves because they were afraid of what might happen. And so what I worry about is not just the conversations between the different entities cooling, but also people knowing the rules of the road, as we've discussed, and stopping themselves or slowing themselves down from doing the good work that they've done because they're afraid and they don't really know how to act. And so I can imagine some of these rigorous processes that I've described getting additional layers of bureaucracy added to them at these technology companies, because they're trying to make sure that their bases are covered so that in case someone comes after them, what does it mean for the actual addressing of these problems? It means that it's just slower. And that's important because when you're dealing with problems like influence operations, moving quickly or as quickly as possible vis-a-vis the threat actor is important. And so I worry that this stuff has slowed down a little bit. The people are still there to do it. The infrastructure is still there. But we need to make sure, as we've discussed throughout this conversation, that people feel safe to have these kinds of conversations and know that it is okay to do so. And know that it's not just about the conversations, but it's about taking the actions and knowing that we can explain them to the public and make people feel safe. Because the broader thing that I worry about whenever people ask me what keeps me up at night, it's not the actual, I know it sounds crazy as a professor who teaches about influence operations and disinformation, it's not the actual threat, it's the perception of the threat. If we don't trust institutions and democracy, then that matters more than whether one meme went viral or not.
I think that's a great point and a great place to end. Thank you for doing this, for coming on. I appreciate you taking the time this afternoon. I thought this was really good.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to my guests. Thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones. Thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.